a kind of teaching that I suppose no one has ever done before. The very idea of black church studies begets a vast variety of responses, and even some of my black brethren are not ready to be called black or to embrace the term which has been so significantly and I think wisely chosen by many of our younger as well as other race members. If the program in which I'm engaged has anything, however, to offer outside the narrow bounds of black ministers who need the cultural formation with which to relate to the black masses in their own idiom, then it seems that we had best get the light out from under the bushel, and this I propose to do for a few moments this evening. Not as a public relations venture or a commercial thing, but perhaps more importantly, in response to what I consider to be the very call of God, a kind of vocation, a thing for which perhaps I and many others were called before we were born. Now, the minute one becomes aware of the need for such a thing as black church studies, he is forced to be sensitive to a whole universe of thinking outside the cultural biases of white Western Christianity. The minute one is aware that there are in America millions of people whose very culture is so different from that of so-called standard or white middle class, the minute one is aware that they have something which is indeed Christianity and which has indeed nourished them through a torture chamber of 350 years existence in a hostile society, then one must be aware that there is something in this which may be of benefit to all men. One of these insights is summed up by the text as read, "For what is a man profited to gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" And the word soul for many people has come to sum up a great deal of black culture in America today. Now, the text, of course, is no new text. For most of European and American Christianity, this text has been very meaningful through the years. But it has been meaningful in a way that has been biased by the dualistic chain of thought, which stretches all the way back to early Greek thought and certainly spells itself out very plainly with Paul and Augustine and the rest, a chain of thought which speaks of the soul as something in separate state from the body, a thing from which the soul must be saved. The two set one against the other, save the soul from the body. There are some people who, in resistance to all this, engage in what they conceive of as a wide practice of neglecting the soul in favor of the body. But under the influence of black culture, soul has come to have a new meaning, and this is the significance which we wish to share tonight. First would be, of course, the fact that everything that is done with soul or with soulfulness, not just with emotional outbursts or expression, but certainly with emotion as well. As one reads the old languages, one is aware that there is no distinction in the New Testament, and certainly there is no distinction in black culture between the word soul and the word life. Indeed, the RSV translates it, "What profits a man to gain the whole world and lose his life?" The two are inextricably bound together. The two words mean virtually the same thing. The prominence of the word soul, therefore, in our day and in black culture is in response to a white context which has somehow not brought the two together and has in the process wound up with a great deal of emptiness, a great lack of soul. And so as we in the black world speak of soul, we speak of something which for many people immediately means the expression of a person like Aretha Franklin, a black preacher's daughter who learned to sing as she now sings in the church, and who did so to the glory of God with fire and with emotion. But there's a great deal more to soul than just that which one sees and hears in renditions such as this. For soul means involvement, passionate praise of God, commitment, a willingness to give to God that which stems from the bottom and warmest parts of our total being. As we sing in soul culture, in black culture, we sing so much of ourselves that we improvise and sing not always the word or the note that is on the line, but out of it we give of our own souls to the praise of God. Soul, as Jesus is using it here, would mean that we translate the text not to say what good is it to live a high life here and then go to hell half so much, as it is perhaps better translated to say what good is it to grasp and accumulate, to seek things at the expense of your very living, your life, your soul. The spiritual quality or the soul quality, therefore, is not some very mystical, distant feeling, but sensitivity to the presence of God in all things. And not alone to the presence of God, but to the presence of other spiritual beings, like other human beings, if you please, people. The spiritual quality or the soul quality is the capacity to be aware of, to respond to other people, as spirits, if you please. And while in many cases, early African culture, which still has a great influence on black or soul religion, was thought to be animistic, at least this was certain and this was true out of the old African culture, that every person was thought to have a spirit and every person was dealt with the full awareness that one must deal with his spirit, which automatically meant that no person could be dealt with as a thing. Jesus tells us in the second text, which was read from Luke, of a man who was very rich. And one reads it and wonders if Jesus had read today's newspapers or watched today's world, for he said that this man had the idea that when he had enough things, when he was secure materially, that he had it made. And Jesus goes on to suggest that that was exactly when he did not have it made, "Thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee." And this is so typical of so much of our society today. But maybe you disagree. Maybe you say our way of life isn't all that bad and you shouldn't be using the pulpit for a whipping post, and really it isn't like that. Let me offer a few suggestions which perhaps will open your mind to the vast possibilities and damaging evidence which is available in support of this suggestion. I think, for instance, of a missionary who went to the Congo and who said that the Bantu language had to be suppressed and that European languages should be implanted so that people would have words with which to cope with modern civilization. There were no terms in the Bantu language for various things that people had, and there were no real ways of dealing with the European worldview. What he was saying was that the Bantu worldview was in itself utterly inadequate, and so he thought it ought to be wiped out. Well, thank goodness he didn't succeed, and the language and the musical quality and the soul quality of Bantu life and language still survives, but a lot of other things don't. The interesting thing is that the people who made all these statements about black culture in Africa did not give even those who learned their culture well any of the advantages that should have come with this. No matter how well they learned the European language and culture, they were not allowed to be in the places where this should have been the ticket. No matter how competent they became in the technical, sterile European culture, they were locked out of it. Their goals, their dreams were suppressed, and they were placed at the bottom of the whole scale of things and the whole relationship with the European countries. And when the Belgians left, as everybody knows, the Congolese had to start from zero, because even those who had learned the culture had not been given any opportunity to practice it in such ways as in government. And if you think that's far away and we ought not to be talking about it over there, let me suggest that a comparably glorious saga of white Western approaches to indigenous people is to be found on our own continent, where the Western achievement was to save and civilize the Indian by killing him off and taking his land. I'm not altogether proud of the fact that in a recent publication, the 9th and 10th Cavalry, two black units of military might, were among those who were used to wipe the Indians off their own plains. And I marvel and am absolutely shocked to realize that it is in the last few weeks, virtually, that we suddenly are aware of the fact that when you take people's land, you ought to compensate them. And I am even now shocked to discover that people think that the Eskimos and the Indians and the Aleuts of Alaska ought not to get the billions that should come from the oil which comes from the land which was theirs and not anybody else's. But you see, we have this idea, we have this arrogance, that when a man's skin is another color, a white man who has power superiority has the right to take whatever he has and do with it whatever he will. One can see how little soul there is in a person like this, and one can see how this definition of glorious human achievement has been so completely despised and denounced by so many of the young of our affluent society today. They drop out of a culture where people can be this cold and utterly soulless. The so-called hippies, forever making many mistakes, are saying to us, nevertheless, that we see how dead our parents are and we would not live with this little bit of soul, and we want out. We renounce your civilizations whose glories are only violent conquest and technical tinkering skill. I look back myself at the extent to which I was caught up in it, and all of us are caught up in it. As a student in the 30s, I was closely involved with some people who didn't much believe in God or democracy, either one for that matter. And time and again, they would challenge me and say, how can you say Christianity is such a great thing? And with utter naivete and utter ignorance, I would declare, but look at the living standards. No other religion has such great living standards as we have. Yeah, look at our living standards. Look what we have done with it. Look how utterly impotent we are before the simple task of making that living standard available to all of our society. In fact, look how utterly determined some people are that it shall not be distributed among all. The New Testament gospel, African culture, and many of our young people today speak as Jesus spoke. What good is it to gain all of these things? What good is it to have moon hardware? What good is it to have spaceships? What good is it to have super transports? What good is it to have color TV? What good is it to have all these things and to be utterly without soul, which is to be without life? Shorter Catechism, which I learned in a Presbyterian college named Lincoln University on the other end of this state, asks the question, what is the chief end of man? And to my utter amazement, they tell the truth. For the Shorter Catechism says that the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. To glorify God, to burst forth in passionate praise, if you please, and to enjoy it, to be soulfully aware of the presence and glory of God, and to do things about it in song and in dance with real feeling, with soul, if you please. The guitars are a symbol of this. And these guitars, for all of the mess I sometimes hear, are heard at times to go along with songs which literally preach the gospel. And time and again, I'm shocked to discover that these soulful hippies and others are actually saying what the gospel has been saying all along. Soul is passionate praise. Soul is also compassion. What profiteth a man if he gain the power to push all the world around at will and have no compassion? My lie in South Vietnam is different from American culture only in degree, for our culture says over and over again, if you are in the way of what we want to do, we must get you out. Some of these youngsters just take it a little too far, but you see, all the while we've had this insensitivity to human spirits. We've treated people like they weren't there or like they were things. And this is an indivisible kind of thing, for if you have no soul for the South Vietnamese, you have no soul for anyone. If you can close your soul up and be utterly unaware of persons as persons, if you can contradict the laws of early African primitive culture, if you please, and violate the spirits of any person, you can violate and indeed will violate the spirits of all people, and that includes your own wife, your own husband, your own children, your own parents. On the black street, they would say that includes your mammy. For if you have no soul for any man, you have no soul for all. A country that can tolerate slavery as long as we did should be expected to have today's ghettos and to be unable to solve them, for there is still entirely too little soul. A country that finds its joy in things will be a country which enjoys the system that gives these things to them. And it will not be at all inclined to follow the African tribal custom, which would never have permitted such transgressions against the spirits of any man, even as God does not. Well, soul is passionate praise, expressiveness. Soul is compassion. And, of course, soul is also what is literally thought of as one looks at this text, the business of principle or character. What profiteth a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own principles? Along with feeling and expression and compassion, there is also in the same package principles, high moral character, honesty, justice, forgiveness, understanding. And perhaps, maybe we've forgotten it, stewardship. And maybe I should say a word or two about that stewardship thing, for pagan culture, backward African culture, always knew that all the earth was God's. It always knew that there was an earth spirit and that you had to deal with the earth spirit. And when you moved from one part of the turf to another part of the turf, you really had to check in with the spiritual owner of that area. And he was a sub-god under a overall god, a one god such as we know. And when you went to his turf, you only took as much as you needed. You never took more than that. And when you did it only out of need and never out of any power-grabbing, money-thirsty sort of thing. The culture they had was a culture which feared people who were greedy and always looking to get more and more, to get ahead of other people. People like this were frowned on. They were not tycoons. They were terribly unpopular. And one looks at that old African culture and wonders what some of those folks would say as they look at us. And see how we've gone contrary to the earth spirit, as it were, and how we have this frightful, terrifying, ecological crisis, all because we have no sense of stewardship, because our character has so eroded that we don't know that the river belongs to God and ought not to have pollutants in it, that the river spirits are especially strong spirits, and you don't put all the things in those rivers that some of us have put in. Soul is character, which looks and knows that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein, and deals with it in this way. All this is soul. And the loss of this kind of soul is living death. Thoreau said that our text, "What profiteth a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul," was such a severe text that a man ought to read it aloud in his lifetime only once. And I suppose almost everybody knows that Charlemagne was buried in a sitting position with a Bible in his hand, in his lap, and his finger pointing to this text, "What profiteth a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul?" But it can come closer than that as I think of four children who were reared in our own home. What profit would it be for them to have a great legacy of money left to them? What profit would it be for me to know that they were financially secure forever if they hadn't soul? What profit would it be for me to be delighted and to spend my time sprucing them up and dressing them and fixing their hair? I'm a stylist with afros, and I delight in attractive young folks, but what a terrible thing it would be for them to be terribly attractive and no soul. Started to say I'd be tickled pink, but pink isn't right the word. But anyway, I would be real tickled if they all had a good education, a master's degree or a doctor's degree and all that. But what good would it be if they had no compassion? If they had no capacity to praise God from the bottom of their hearts, if somehow in their early days they had not picked up something which would last all their lifetimes, when they would learn with great joy to pour out the very praises of God. I see that one of the speakers in this series is Bishop Roy Nichols, and I remember we being college classmates at Lincoln University some years ago, camping together in the high Sierras up in Yosemite National Park before you couldn't get a place to camp there. And I remember standing around a campfire with our two families and drawing a church full of young people from Southern California, and eventually something like 50 or 60 people, and simply from the bottoms of our hearts singing with soul the praise of God, one of the most glorious things that I've ever done anywhere in my lifetime. That is soul, and what good would it be to gain all of these other things and not have somehow given them this wonderful quality, this likeness unto God, for we are made in His image. I suppose I would just die if it ever came that I had succeeded in all these other things and had no time for their soul. What profit is a man to gain all this stuff and foolishness and technical tinkering and lose one's very life in the bargain? Let us pray. Father, we pray thy benediction upon these scathing words. May they somehow, like surgical incisions, come to souls that may yet be healed.